Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here with a brand new edition of After Dark Radio here at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Also up at Facebook, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. We got a great program today, as we, of course, do every single week, joined by John Michael Greer, Monsters, an Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings. That will be the subject of the show today. John Michael Greer is going to be up on the, he's going to be up here on the show in about a half hour. But of course, as always, we're going to be opening up with Carl Stern to talk about all of the news. And in fact, a wilderness adventure. So that is coming up in a moment as well. Don't forget, AfterDarkRadioShow.com is the place to go for daily updates. The strangest news in the world is up there at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And again, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Head up there, click like, and if you head to the website, you can get a full listing of all of the shows we have ever done. Scroll up to the left-hand side of the page, click on Past Shows, and right there is a list of every show that Carl and I have ever done. We've talked about everything. UFOs, Night Hags, Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper, Area 51, Majestic 12 Documents, the list goes on and on. They're all free at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And if you like the show, please feel free to spread the word to your friends, and let's get more people tuning in and listening to this program. And Carl, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. It's a very nice October day, and I was just sitting here reading about your guest book, and this is awesome. I'm like about to order this thing for the Kindle right now. Why true vampires are the least attractive and most destructive of all monsters. And the one that got me the most is how to survive a chimera encounter with beings such as the Jersey Devil, Chupacabra, and Mothman.
That's right. That's right. In fact, this book, this is either a positive or a negative, depending on how you look at it. But for those of you that love Twilight, or for those of you that hate Twilight, the author of that book, apparently a lot of the different things that were talked about, and a lot of the creatures and phenomenon in the Twilight series, a lot of that is covered in this book, and the author believes that the author of the Twilight series read his book and came up with some ideas for that series. So if you are interested in werewolves and vampires and the whole nine yards, and you want to know the true story behind a lot of these legends, this book is for you. So we're going to talk a lot about that today. Not Twilight, but I got a lot of stuff that I want to talk to him about, including something we talked about, I believe, last week or a couple of weeks ago, the old hag, the Night Hag. We've talked about that on this program, and he's got some...
Have you ever had the unfortunate incident to get drugged to one of these Twilight movies?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. My daughter is 20 years old now, or about to turn 20. So she was just the perfect age to, when those things hit, to be all enamored with the Twilight series. So, of course, I get drugged to the first Twilight movie, and I sat there in the theater of just wanting to gouge my eyes out. That was not aimed at me, I'll tell you that.
So I have not sold a book here.
By the time the sequels came out, thank God she was old enough to drive on her own and go. But, oh, my dear Lord, those things were awful.
Well, we'll forget I said anything about Twilight in plugging the book.
I think you should most definitely watch the first one just to have endured the life experience. But the book looks fascinating. I can't wait to hear from the author. Where Dragons Are Found Today, That has intrigued me enough to order this book, which is apparently available on Kindle and other sources as well. But look forward to hearing from this guy.
All right, let's talk about some of the news of the day. I do recall that last week when we were on the show, you said that you were about to head out on a wilderness journey, and the fact that you're on the show here, I haven't even asked you how things have gone yet off the air, but presumably they went well enough that you're alive. So
they went great, actually. I wish I would have had this book with me. Perhaps I could have learned the magical origins of werewolf legends while I was out there, but sadly, there was no such supernatural encounter. I did post some pictures to the Carl Stern Facebook page if you're a friend on there. If not, then add me for sure. I'll put some photos up there. I drove by what could only possibly be a government death ray, and I have photos of this giant governmental construction that it just has to, it just looks too ominous not to be something evil. So I photographed that. I also photographed, as we talked about here on the show, back in the first season, was Aunt Jenny Johnson and where she is supposed to haunt travelers through the Bankhead Forest. I put photographs of the intersection there where she is supposed to appear. Apparently she did not want to ride with me that day because she never appeared, but I did spend a couple days there and had a great time. Weather was awesome, just perfect weather. The Bankhead National Forest, which encompasses the Sipsey Wilderness areas, is one of the largest wilderness areas in the United States, preserved, very, very stringently preserved. There are a lot of guidelines you have to adhere by to camp there to keep it as pristine as possible. So it's essentially looks the same now as it has through antiquity, and there are literally hundreds, if not, I think one count I read was there were 400 and something naturally occurring waterfalls in the wilderness area itself. And so it was quite a nice little vacation and a good way to get a good place to get away from everything. Unfortunately, no encounters with Bigfoot, ghost, or dragons, but I guess I need this book to tell me where they're found today, apparently.
Or as my grandmother calls them, the Sasquatch.
The Sasquatch, yes.
Yes.
There has actually been, I remember this years and years ago, I couldn't have been 10 years old at the time, but there was a reported Bigfoot sighting in this area. This would have been probably around 1977, 78, 79, somewhere right around there, where Bigfoot prints were apparently left out near on a farm about, oh gosh, this is probably 5 or 6 miles from where I presently live. No photographs were taken and no actual sightings of the Sasquatch took place, but there were footprints discovered, and I believe they were cast, although never heard anything else about it over the year. Of course, that was the height, really, the late 1970s, mid-late 1970s was kind of the last hurrah of the Bigfoot hysteria in America. Of course, it all stemmed, a lot of it off the famous Patterson film, and then it got into the pop culture, and there was even Saturday morning shows about Bigfoot, and of course he was a character on the 1970s series The $6 Million Man that was very popular back in the mid 1970s. So that was like the when Bigfoot was really in the national, I guess, pop culture. And so it was not surprising that people everywhere were seeing Bigfoots then. It does seem to have had somewhat of a comeback in the last 5 or 10 years of new Bigfoot sightings and research and specials out there, but nothing like it was back in the day.
The Patterson footage just turned 44, in fact.
Yeah, that's that was really what, I mean, the Bigfoot legend had been around, you know, forever, even dating back to, you know, the Native Americans and so forth had their own version of where the term Sasquatch came from, is my understanding. But really, it got into the American pop culture to begin with the Patterson film. That was kind of really kicked off the hysteria. Then it sort of died down for a while and made a big comeback again in the 70s, it seems. But unfortunately, I've never got to see a Bigfoot that I know of. There are, we are getting a lot more bears here. I don't know how populated they are up in the Pacific Northwest where you are, but there have been random bear sightings throughout the years here, but they're getting more and more populated. They seem to be migrating down this way. There was a study done recently that said our bear population here in the Deep South had almost doubled from what it was 20 years ago. And so I expect with more bears coming about that might translate into more Bigfoot sightings. I don't know, but certainly are. They're not very often seen around here, but they are starting to become more well known, and you'd start getting a lot more reports of them now.
When I was a youngster, this would have been 30 years ago, a bear ran through our yard, chased by some other youngsters. Suffice to say that when I have my own youngsters, there will not be bears running through the yard. The place has changed. Now, one thing, since you were out in the wilderness, and we've been talking about this, one of the stories on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com is a story here about why ghosts are spooked by HD cameras. And the article talks about the fact that times have changed. We now have the iPhone 4S, for example, has, I forget the, it's a significantly more powerful camera. It shoots 1080p HD video. This is a high-end video and normal camera on a phone. And so, you know, you would think nowadays, my God. And with trail cams as well, man, we should be seeing these, taking photos of beasts and UFOs and Sasquatch and everything like that. See, it's seeing these things everywhere, and we don't, which is a sobering thought for people that that want to believe.
Yeah, that's always been one of my big hang-ups with the amount of reports about things. I mean, not just Bigfoot, but, you know, like you said, other things, chupacabra and so forth. You would think, again, with the proliferation of cameras everywhere, especially, you know, here in the Deep South, I mean, this is prime hunting area. I mean, it's in our culture to hunt, deer hunting and whatever throughout the year, especially during the fall and winter seasons, which is deer season around here. It's just, I mean, there are people fanatical about it. It is not just a sport to a lot of people. It's not just it's a cultural thing. It really is. It's passed down from generation to generation. I personally have never been that big into the whole deer hunting scene, but I mean, it's all around me. I mean, kids are raised to deer hunt, especially this time of year. I think the deer season just began like last weekend or so. And so the woods and the forest and all the different areas of which there are a lot of timber here in this area are just inundated now with hunters, with deer cameras, with wildlife game cameras, with people in the woods with cell phones, with cameras and so forth. And you would think exponentially the number of sightings and photographs would increase. And I would expect a dramatic increase over the last 5 or 6 years of these photos, and I don't know that we've really seen that. I mean, there have been a few hoaxes over the last few years in Georgia. I believe it was last year, year before last, there was a supposed killed Bigfoot that was put in a freezer, and the photographs circulated around, and it looked really, really fake, and apparently that was very quickly resolved as to be a hoax. And but besides anomalies like that that are clearly hoaxes, it just doesn't seem like a lot of good quality stuff has come out, even with things like, you know, the chupacabra and so forth. Although there occasionally you'll pop up a random photo here and there on the internet of a unidentified dog-like creature or something, but you almost never hear the follow-up to that, which to me suggest it was identified as some sort of, you know, perhaps deformed or mutated dog or something like that, and not necessarily a unidentified species. But, you know, I'm not sure. It's just one of the things that I think throws a major wrench in the works of cryptozoology, is the fact that we've got all these resources and not really an exponential increase in sightings, photographs, captures, and things like that. Because I'm telling you what, these people around here that are by the hundreds roaming through the woods right now with high-powered rifle, you know, morality aside, if they come up on a Bigfoot, I know what's going to happen. And, you know, so
ain't gonna be pretty.
Not happening. And that certainly increases my skepticism of such.
I wanted to talk about some of the technological stories that are up on our site right now. We, of course, cover science and technology as well, some of the fascinating things about it, and three interesting stories. Well, two interesting stories, but one we've been talking about for a while. If you go to the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now, there is a video here of a levitating disc. Quantum levitation is the video. And also on the page is a story about how MIT researchers are developing a device that sees through walls. So if you've been listening to the show over the past 6 months or so, we have now been talking about seeing through walls, levitation, and invisibility. What kind of world are we living in now, Carl?
You know, it's really one of the things we should do at some point is a story on the Philadelphia experiment and post invisibility attempts and so forth, because that really seems like invisibility, camouflage, and so forth is one of the big fields that the military is starting to invest a lot more in again. It's always been something they've dabbled in, but it's never really, you know, it's a very difficult thing to accomplish. And the Philadelphia experiment itself back in, I believe it took place in the 1940s or 1950s, was just, that's a whole other thing to itself. But the gist of it is the attempt to develop invisibility. It certainly has enormous military applications. Obviously, it's the ultimate form of camouflage. And you would think now, as technology advances, that it's going to, we're getting closer and closer to the day when a true sort of stealth or invisibility on a manageable level is going to be created. And I think we're probably just, I don't know, I really kind of think in the next several years we will start to see more and more of that being put to use, actually developed in the military. And you know how when seems like when somebody finally gets the formula right that other people can build successfully on top of, it seems to be the way that a lot of inventions do take off. Somebody finally lays the proper foundation and other people build on it. And I think that's what we're seeing now with invisibility and so forth. There's been a lot of stories lately I saw one just the other day on the History Channel where, you know, an invisibility cloak. Of course, they've been working on such things for a few years, but they really seem to be getting closer and closer now to the being successful with that.
I'm actually trying to find, I had a video up as well on the page. I actually can't find it here, but I seem to recall that there was a video of, here it is, it's on page 3 right now. Invisibility cloak uses mirages to make objects vanish. And essentially there's a, it's a 20-second video, and something is in the water, and whatever they're using as an invisibility cloak, you can actually see the deal in the water disappear. So we've got videos here on the site of objects disappearing and objects levitating. I don't have video of being able to see around a wall yet, but presumably that's going to be up here pretty soon. But it's pretty fascinating. Life is going to change in interesting ways. You know, you obviously at this point, it is far in the future. I shouldn't even say far in the future. It is in the future, the idea of throwing a cloak over yourself and suddenly you cannot be seen. But the way that technology is advancing, it may not be all that far into the future that something like this will be possible. Again, I think we've talked about on the show many times, one of the worst things to attempt to do in predicting the future is to take things the way they are right now and extrapolate them 10, 15, 20 years. It's just not the way that things work. That's why if you go back and read old books about predictions for the future, they're almost all wrong. You know, every now and then there will be certain concepts that people predicted that will have come to pass. But, you know, most predictions are, okay, you know, we're doing horse and buggy now, so in, 50 years there's going to be a super horse or something. I don't know. But the point is, you cannot extrapolate into the future what is happening today. Things are going to change. So, you know, the idea of an invisibility cloak, you know, in 10 years, they may be moved far beyond the idea of a cloak. Maybe it's going to be an invisibility bodysuit, or maybe it's going to be, currently it's like a tube that you put over yourself. So we don't know where things are going to go, but in 10, 15 years, things are going to be amazing.
Yeah, you know, you've brought this point up before, and it's really something that I don't think a lot of people truly understand, but really is correct, that technology doesn't necessarily advance linearly. It's almost impossible. It's just exactly as you said. You can't take what we have now and project it 10, 15 years into the future, because usually what happens is not necessarily improvements upon technology. While that happens on a smaller scale, on a more macro scale, it's usually spin-offs of such, or ideas that are influenced by certain things. And I know, just involved with law enforcement, in the 17 years I've been involved in law enforcement, you never would have expected the way things have gone. When I first began, on our belts, I mean, we carried a gun and a stick and handcuffs, and that's was your level of force you used. You know, you used an impact weapon to subdue resisting people, and a gun to shoot them with in lethal situations. Well, as I think society progressed and ideas changed, non-lethal responses became something that got into the mix. Where back when I first began, it was more like, you know, if you hit them with one thing and that don't work, hit them harder with something else and keep doing. And that sounds so archaic and barbaric now, but that was the mindset then coming out, because we didn't have all these other alternatives. And the first thing that was introduced when early on in my law enforcement career was the combination of pepper spray and tear gas together in one combination. They're all mace had been around for, of course, years, but it was largely ineffective. I mean, it was okay for animal attacks and things like that, but as far as using against people, it was very hit and miss. And so I remember one of the first school, I was one of the first people in this area trained on using what is called Freeze Plus P, which is a combination of OC and CS spray. It's a combination of Oreo resin capsaicin, which is pepper spray, and tear gas together in one canister. And when they sold the training to us and then the product, it was like, this will end your having to fight people. This is it. You spray them with this magic spray and the fight's over with. You handcuff them and take them to jail, and that's the end of that. Well, in application, it's much more difficult than that. It may be improved altercation success up from, you know, 30% up to maybe 50% or a little better, but it wasn't the cure-all everybody said it was. So the next, but at the same time, impact weapons kind of went by the wayside. They started being used less and less, because now there was this magic spray that would end fights for you instead of having to use a stick. Well, then along came the taser. And the taser is, of course, presently the next magic gadget that ends all conflict. And in fact, that is not the case either. It also has a fairly substantial fail ratio as well. And it's an effective tool. And, you know, having seen it, having been certified on it for a few years now, it's impressive in a controlled environment, but in the chaotic real world, not necessarily so. And then there's misapplications of it, and you get morons that use it in the wrong situations, and then times where it's believed, you know, by the general public to be this thing that, oh, my God, you know, you should never have to ever do anything but tase somebody, because that ends it, when in fact it's has a substantial fail ratio. And so, you know, the I don't know what the next non-lethal response to an aggressive attack would be. I know they're working on different things, but I'm betting it's not a super taser. I bet it goes a different direction. I know they're for large crowd controls and stuff, they're using things now like these rubber bullets and stuff like that, which that technology's been around for a while, but it's been improved to the point it's used. They're using sound wave technology things. But again, this is for large riot-type situations, not necessarily one-on-one combat. So, again, if 17 years ago, if you would have asked me, you know, what would we be doing now, I would have never guessed what it would be we would be doing now, that, you know, almost no officers anymore would be carrying impact weapons or pepper spray or mace or anything like that. And I'm betting that 10 years from now, I won't be able to guess what we'll be doing then either. But we're certainly moving away from, very quickly away from lethal weaponry into non-lethal alternatives. And it's probably, it's truthfully the way we really should be going. If you have something that's super effective and dependable, but it never seems like anything lives up to the hype, but it's hard to tell, really, like you said, where it's going, and hard to predict the future in that.
All right, Carl, let's get the plugs in here for your stuff.
Okay, well, the big three I've got is my website, which is carlstern.com. It's Carl with the letter K, K-A-R-L-S-T-E-R-N.com. Definitely hit that site up because I am hawking my Stern Stick audio flash drives. I have two available, a 2 gig and a 4 gig, each with different content. So check out that website and order as many as you would like. I've begun shipping them all this week, and hope so far so good. Got a lot of great feedback to it. On Twitter, I am Dragon King Carl, and I do tweet quite frequently. And a lot of the stuff of interest to After Dark fans, I retweet on there, so you can keep up with that sort of stuff. And the other is my Facebook page of Carl Stern. Look me up and friend me, and post a lot of pictures and so forth on there. And again, you can keep up with a lot of the stuff that goes on at After Dark, and also the WrestlingObserver.com site, and try to keep everybody updated with what's going on. On all those places, Carl Stern and Dragon King Carl on Twitter.
And, of course, our website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We're going to be back in just a moment, joined by John Michael Greer, the author of Monsters, an investigator's guide to magical beings. Going to be a great time here on After Dark Radio at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are back here on the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We are joined by a very special guest today. John Michael Greer is on the show, author of Monsters, an Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings, a book that, in fact, is, I guess, reissued after 10 years. It's been updated. And you may not have read the book, but I guarantee that if you've ever been to a bookstore and you've gone into the section, it used to be called a cult, I don't know what they call it today, but if you've ever been in the section that has the books about UFOs and such, guaranteed you've seen this book, because I don't think I've ever been in a bookstore and I have not seen it. And John, how are you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you.
The book, before we get into it, I should mention that I was looking at your Wikipedia page, and you were born in Bremerton, Washington. I'm here in Bothell, Washington.
Oh, you're in Bothell. Okay,
I'm in Bothell, yeah. So, and I guess now you're living, you moved to Oregon, and now you've moved to the East Coast. Is that correct?
Well, not quite the East Coast. We're in Cumberland, Maryland, my wife and I, which is a little red brick mill town in the middle of the Appalachians.
Oh, about that. What made you decide to move out there?
Well, partly the cost of living is a lot lower than it is out on the West Coast, and
sure,
the quality of life is very nice. Real estate prices are rock bottom, and the people are very friendly, and we decided to give it a shot.
Now, the fact that the book has been, I guess, reissued here after 10
mm-hmm.
years, updated,
mm-hmm.
I presume that, obviously, it's sold very well over the last 10 years. When you wrote the book, obviously, it's a great title, Monsters. I mean, when you look at the cover, it's just, there are two eyes, and it says Monsters.
Monsters, yeah.
When you wrote this book, were you expecting it to be as big a hit as presumably it became?
Oh, nothing like that. I was between major projects. I've been doing a number of other things on some of the very sort of austere and intellectual ends of esoteric theory, and I was between projects, wasn't sure where my career was going, and just decided, hey, let's try something like this. And I couldn't think of any more imaginative title for a book on monsters than Monsters. And I pitched it to Llewellyn. They picked it up and ran with it. I got what is still really the best cover that I've ever had on a book. And away it went. And yes, it is, as far as I know, it's still my best-selling title.
I would say that's the best cover of a book in almost the history of books. It's got to be way up there. It's just...
It's a good title.
I mean, I literally, every time I've gone to a bookstore, I mean, they always, like, turn the book out, so instead of looking at the spine, you're looking at the cover.
You're looking at the eyes. Yeah. I mean, it's a great selling cover, what can I say?
And a great book. One of the things I liked about the book, and it's available, by the way, on Amazon.com. If you go to the page, there's only 9 left in stock, but fear not, the Kindle version never runs out of stock, and I've got
They will be getting more, also. Trust me.
That's right. They'll be getting more.
Like I say, the truck is already on its way from the warehouse.
Really? Well, that's very good. But check it out, everybody. The one of the interesting things about the book, I used to love reading books by John Keel.
Oh man, yes,
yes,
yes.
And
the Mothman Prophecies was a huge favorite of mine in my teen years.
Exactly. And reading your book, it seems that you've got kind of a similar philosophy mm-hmm. about these monsters as John Keel. I mean, he kind of had this idea that it was just like you always hear these stories about fairies or whatever the case might be, and that they're always behaving in such a strange way and. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess give everybody your philosophy about, let's just take, I guess, any sort of monster, for example, and, mm-hmm. and your thoughts on the nature of reality and these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Keel's book that we just referred to, The Mothman Prophecies, had a final chapter that the title was something like, "To Heck with the Answer, What's the Question?"
Sure.
And that's really the best place to start in dealing with all of these very strange experiences that people have, because people do experience things like ghosts and other monstrous beings. They have these encounters, and we're left fumbling trying to come up with an explanation for them. I think it was Terence McKenna who asked rhetorically, you know, where is it written that a bunch of upright apes should necessarily be able to understand the wonder and glory of the universe? You know, we don't have any guarantee that the universe will ever make sense to us.
Sure.
And monstrous beings are one of the places where that really comes out, where we encounter things that just baffle us completely.
Thing about the, I want to talk about fairies here. I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but I'm mm-hmm. going to talk about them now because I've always been interested in them because I'm a big fan of Jacques Vallée as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's another old fave of mine.
Yes, and of course he. You know, he looks at this as a phenomenon. I mean, everybody, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people nowadays look at UFOs and are like, oh, they're creatures from another world. And he's like, no, this stuff goes back forever. Mm-hmm. You know, people have been seeing the same thing for thousands of years, and they've always just given it a different sort of name.
Mm-hmm. They've assigned it a meaning and a context that they derive from their culture. In the Middle Ages, it was fairies. Nowadays, we don't believe in fairies, but we believe in aliens from space. So they've got to be aliens from space. Same
sure.
phenomenon, different label.
So I want to ask you about this because it's something I've never had a chance to interview Jacques Vallée, but mm-hmm. you know, hopefully someday. But
I hope you have the chance. That'd be cool to listen to.
Yes, one of the things is both with aliens and fairies and a lot of these other phenomenon. One of the things that always stuck out, and John Keel wrote about it as well, is they always say the strangest things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's always kind of intrigued me. You know, people would have these encounters with fairies, and the fairies would say something just preposterous.
Just totally off the wall.
Off the wall. I mean, I know you've obviously thought about this a lot, but why is that?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that whatever these things are, they don't experience the world the way we do. They do not, in some ways, they don't share quite the same world that we share. So much of what we experience about the world is a product of our own culture, is a product of our own nervous systems. Whatever these other entities may be, they don't share that. And so nothing they say is quite going to make sense to us, and nothing we say will ever quite make sense to them. I suspect, you know, they sit at home wherever home is and scratch their heads and go, these weird human creatures, you would not believe what one of them said to me.
Sure. Now, on that topic, I was interested in reading the book about the Little Earths of Puget Sound, because, mm-hmm. of course, I live in Puget Sound.
There we go.
Tell everybody about the Little Earths.
Okay. Well, it's the Coast Salish people, the native people who used to live, and so, of course, in reservations still do live in the Puget Sound area, have a set of accounts of creatures that are practically identical to fairy lore from anywhere else in the world. I'm not going to try to pronounce their name, but it translates as Little Earths. My Lushootseed is just not up to that. And they're short, they are magical, They're very good at appearing and disappearing. They live in these low mound-like dwellings off in the deeps of the forest and this kind of stuff, exactly like fairy lore from Europe. And yet, as far as anyone can tell, these legends were being told about the little Earths long before the first white people came onto the scene in the Puget Sound area. And of course, that those sort of low mounds, it probably has not escaped many people's attention that those look remarkably like our idea of UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a book, I'm not remembering at the moment the name of the author, but the title was The Dragon and the Disc. F.W. Holliday was the author, and he pointed out that there are all of these strange, tangled symbolisms that go back and forth between disc-shaped things, like round mounds and barrows and things like that, and dragon-shaped things, long, linear things, like the long barrows in Britain. And he subtitled his book, An Investigation into the Utterly Fantastic, which is a good bit of warning, because he was dealing with stuff that makes literally no sense to us. And yet there does seem to be this alternation. There are also dragons in Peter Sound Leonard.
Dragons? You have a chapter on dragons.
I have a chapter on dragons.
Yes.
Actually, you have to remember, I lived in the Puget Sound area when I wrote this book. I lived in Seattle. And once, along with a friend, we went to look for a stone, which is out near the Fauntleroy Ferry Dock. And it is it's a stone where back in old times, the Coast Salish people used to say, this is where an Iohos lives, and that's their dragon, okay? And young men who wanted to get a powerful warrior spirit would go out to that rock at sunset, and they'd stay there all night. And if they were still alive the next morning, they had that warrior spirit as their totem spirit, the Tamanoas. And otherwise, they'd be found with their head twisted off.
That's no good.
You're running certain risks if you're going to try to get an Iohos as your totem spirit. But yeah, so they have the dragon and they have the disc. They have the little creatures, remarkably like greys, that hang around in disc shaped dwellings in hidden places and occasionally abduct people. And they have the long linear dragons who typically hang out near water and have certain powers and will occasionally twist your head off.
Now, did you find the stone?
Yes.
Did you stay there all night?
No. We tried to take a picture of it, and my friend's camera, which had given him no trouble in like 15 years of use, produced a horrible whirring, grinding sound, and I think a lot of the gears inside it turned into whatever metal turns into when it, you know, kind of a metal chowder. It cost some hundreds of dollars to get the poor thing repaired, yeah. The Iohos obviously did not want to have anybody take a picture of its rock.
I've been to the Fauntleroy Ferry Dock many times, and
yeah, go down and walk south along the beach. You'll notice after you go, it's a quarter mile or so. You'll find a large rock. It's sitting kind of not quite in somebody's yard. That's the rock.
Interesting. Now, obviously, living in Seattle, I'm sure there were many other things you investigated. And while this show goes all over the world, I'm in Seattle, so I'm going to ask questions. Mm-hmm. What other fascinating, landmarks or legends are there in this area?
Oh, Seattle, like most towns that have been around a while, Seattle is riddled with ghosts. There are ghosts in the Pike Place Market.
Mm-hmm.
That are seen there quite regularly. There are various haunted houses in town. What's the theater up on Capitol Hill? Just
where? Oh, is it Landmark?
Broadway.
Landmark?
No, I'm trying to remember the place.
Oh, I.
At any rate, it's right across from the Daughters of the American Revolution Hall there, and that they have a ghost there, and a lot of the old Masonic lodges and Oddfellow lodges and things like that in town, that most of those are haunted. It's a good town for ghosts.
Interesting. Now, another thing, since we're on the subject of fairies and some of the things going back many years, I think you've done a lot of work on circles and magic and that sort of thing, and always interested in the idea that nowadays everyone sees crop circles and they presume, oh, this must have been created by an alien craft, and meanwhile, if you went back 300 years, it'd be, oh, this is where the fairies dance.
This is where the fairies were dancing. There you
sure.
go. Yeah. Well, crop circles are there's an additional level of complexity in that the whole crop circle thing, it's kind of faded down now, but a few years back when there was this big foo-foo-rah, a lot of crop circles were being manufactured by decidedly magical in the sense that they were practicing rituals, but it was a performance art thing. And it was also something that the farmers out in the west of Britain were very strongly encouraging, because the take for one season worth of crop circle viewing, at a pound a piece for entry, was way past what you'd make from growing crops in the same fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things to keep in mind is just because these phenomena do apparently exist, people do encounter them, there are also fakes. There are also frauds. There are also various complicated human motivations that go into producing some of these experiences.
There's actually, I think in the New Fordian Times, there's a photo of a crop circle, and it is of an alien smoking a cigar, which I would presume would be one of the fakes.
That's nice.
That would be my guess. Were you talking about the Harvard Exit Theater, by the way?
Thank you. Yes, the Harvard Exit, that's one. They've got I don't know how long it's been since they last had one, but that was a ghost who would occasionally light fires in the fireplace.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That seems like it would be trouble.
It apparently was a very well-behaved ghost. It wasn't like big fires or anything, but they'd go up there every so often, and somebody had set a fire in the fireplace, and none of the staff had been there.
Now, where would you rank something like the Bigfoot? Would you put that in something that would be perhaps, say, an actual creature not yet discovered? Would you put that in the chimera category? Obviously, some people report some strange non-animalistic deals with Sasquatch, but what would you say?
Well, it's a hard thing to say as a blanket statement. Sasquatch, generally the critter that is seen up and down the Cascades, that has a very specific appearance and things like that, that's probably an undiscovered animal. I mean, we even know what probable genus it belongs to. Gigantopithecus, which was as late as the Ice Age, was all over East Asia, as far as Siberia could have come across the land bridge, with perfect grace. And it basically looked like a Sasquatch. It's a large, hairy, biped ape. But, of course, in other places, people also see various strange-looking, hairy, humanoid critters. And some of those are pretty clearly just weird. And there are things going on there that are not physical in nature. When you find a whole line of tracks and they begin out of thin air and end in thin air, that's probably not an animal.
Every now and then you'll hear a story of someone, they'll say, oh, I saw this disco down in the woods and I went over there and there was a Bigfoot by this disc. And it's like, so it seems kind of like a strange combination there, you know?
It is a strange combination. John Keel would have loved that kind of, would probably still love that kind of thing. I don't know what he's up to these days. But, that's very much the kind of thing where unexplained phenomena just kind of blend together and flow into each other, and we don't know what's going on. To heck with the answer, what's the question?
Interesting thing about, I think it was John Keel that wrote about this, I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I forget where I read this, but I was fascinated by it. Going back to fairies very quickly, the word itself... fae, I guess, is the original word, or one of the original words that the word fairy became later. And somebody noted that a lot of the cities here in the United States and elsewhere that have the word fae in the name, like Fayetteville, for example.
Fayetteville or Lafayette, or, yeah,
exactly.
For some reason, they tend to have this magnetic attraction to weird events.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by this.
I should know this. Who was it that wrote The Rebirth of Pan? At any rate, there are a number of, it's been discussed in Fordian Phenomena books rather extensively. And why that should be the case?
Joe Walton.
Nobody knows. Yeah.
Joe Walton, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I just always, I don't know where I first read that, but I was so fascinated by this idea.
It's one of those things where you just scratch your head, you know. It makes more sense that you come across a place that is devils, you name it, and something weird happens there.
Sure. Now, in your opinion, I mean, I haven't read enough on this, I presume you have, but for a place like Fayetteville, I mean, is the presumption that because it was named Fayetteville, it attracted these things, or was it a deal where going back years and years and years and years, it was a haunted place, so to speak, and thus it got a name like Fayetteville?
Well, as far as we know, very few people remembered that Fayette had a connection to, like, elves and things like that. So no, things got named after people. you know, after, you know, just as there's there are towns named Washington and Franklin and Jefferson, there's a lot of Lafayettes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was famous. If you need a name for your town, it's no, you don't want it to be Doo-Wumps, which is what Seattle almost got named.
Unfortunate.
I think it would have been great. The greater Doo-Wumps Chamber of Commerce would have kept some of the immigration out.
Yes. You know, this summer I went up to Chief Seattle's grave,
mm-hmm.
and there was nobody there. It was mm-hmm. empty, and it was just very quiet. It's right there on the water. And mm-hmm. Any stories about Chief Seattle, his gravesite, or anything like that?
Nothing that I've encountered. I imagine typically the native peoples tend to keep their mouths tightly shut about anything like that around white folks.
Interesting.
And, you know, it's not as though we haven't hassled them enough. So, you know, I know a very few people, very few white people who have good enough relations with the native people in the res, out at the res, where, you know, they get invited to certain ceremonies and things like that. And even they say, look, there's a lot of stuff that I know I'll never find out about.
I presume you know the stories of things that have gone on at the Skinwalker Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
Now, my question about that is I read a great book on that, and mm-hmm. The name, the term Skinwalker.
Skinwalker, Gentle Bushi, yeah, in Navajo.
Yeah, that is now I guess the question is, was the ranch given that name because strange things had happened on the ranch, or again, did it just happen to be called the Skinwalker Ranch, and by God, all this strange stuff is happening here?
Almost certainly it will have been named after, because Skinwalkers were a known phenomenon there, again, thousands of years before whites showed up.
Sure.
Skinwalker is a translation of a Native American term. So probably, you know, whoever named the ranch originally might have been going, ha ha ha, you know, these Indians have this superstition, but he still took the name, and it was still based on, you know, stuff happening there.
Many
of the places that are named Devil's This and Devil's That,
exactly.
It's a translation of a Native America thing, saying, you know, this is a place where there are evil spirits or what have you. And somebody says, okay, we'll call it, you know, Devil's Bluff or Devil's Hill or Devil's Lake or what have you.
Tell everybody about the Skinwalkers.
The Skinwalkers, one thing that a lot of people who were raised on, before Twilight hit the big time, a lot of people did not know that there were a lot of shape-shifting and werewolf-style legends all through Native American culture, especially in the western half of the continent. Down in the southwest, skinwalkers are the local equivalent of werewolves. They'll typically are believed to take on coyote form. Except it's not quite natural coyote form. When you're driving down the desert highway and, you know, 50 miles an hour, and you notice that there appears to be a coyote trotting alongside the road at the same speed that you're going, you know that something weird is going on. And people report this kind of thing quite frequently. So they are thought to be rather nasty customers. And the local accounts of skinwalkers, of Yenal Lushi, Not the sort of people you want to tangle with at all. They engage in a lot of very nasty magical stuff.
There's a guest on Coast to Coast often, Linda Godfrey, who mm-hmm. wrote The Beast of Bray Road, which sounds like something, a werewolf-style creature.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know about The Beast of Bray Road?
That's actually one I haven't followed up on yet.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get around to it. I don't get a lot of chances to listen to Coast AM. It's just, you know, it doesn't really fit with my schedule at the moment.
Sure. And there was another one, the Michigan Dog Man.
The Michigan Dog Man. There's always kind of a monster. It's not quite a monster of the week club, but monsters come in and go out in fashion. And it's good that people are aware of them. But it's also important to remember that wherever you live, there are ghosts and monsters and things like that that people have encountered within a short distance of wherever you are. You don't have to go to Michigan to encounter some kind of strange creature with a dog-like head.
It's kind of depressing, in fact. I wish I would have to leave to find something like that.
Oh, no. There are creepy creatures all over the place.
Now, you mentioned Twilight, and I guess we don't have any proof of this, but there's a strong possibility that the Twilight series in some ways was based on things written about in your book.
Well, there's one specific detail. I don't happen to know. But as far as I know, up until quite recently, my book was the only place in readily available source on monster lore that mentioned that Northwest Coast Native American tribes in particular have a very rich tradition of werewolves, of lycanthropy, and of shapeshifting into wolf form. It's all over the Northwest Coast. And again, it's not something that gets shared with white people a lot, and it's one of those things that maybe people will talk about it if they trust you. But the anthropologists 100 years ago documented it in some detail when they were a little more, they hadn't really taken our measure yet. And so it so happened when I was doing research for the book, I was at the University of Washington Library, was where I did a lot of the research for this, mm-hmm. and there were all of these very interesting anthropological accounts where they're talking about how among the Quileute and some of the other tribes on the coast, where they have this wolf magic and they have this tradition of shape-shifting into wolf form. And so I wrote about that in my book. And again, it was, as far as I know, until Twilight saw print, basically the only widely available source, unless you want to go digging in anthropological reports from the 1890s, that sure. discussed this thing. And then all of a sudden we get Twilight with, the Native American werewolves out on the, out in the reservation near Forks.
Interesting.
So it's, we'll see, but it would not surprise me utterly. And then, and if that's what happens, that's totally fine. It is one of the privileges of a fiction writer to ransack good ideas or from wherever they can find them.
When did you first get interested in this topic?
I don't remember a time when I wasn't interested in monsters.
Infancy.
It's just about. I don't think there were strange, creepy creatures looming over my cradle or anything like that. But if there were, it would not surprise me.
Now, that obviously begs the question, have you seen any of these?
I have had a couple of encounters with things that were probably ghosts. I haven't seen, I have never encountered a vampire, sparkly or otherwise. I'll pass on the sparkly vampires with teen angst, really. And most of the others are quite rare, but I've had a couple of encounters with things that I think may have been ghosts. I have heard haunted house phenomenon quite frequently. I used to belong to the Oddfellows Lodge down in Ballard, mm-hmm. and routinely we'd be down in the ground floor because there's two lodge rooms. There's a downstairs and an upstairs, and the upstairs is the big room, and so it's usually locked most of the time because there aren't that many big lodges these days. So the upstairs would be locked, and we'd be downstairs having a meeting, and all of a sudden there'd be footsteps walking across the floor in the locked and dark upstairs hall. And if you listen very carefully and kind of track them, you realize that the footsteps are following the pattern that some of the officers walk in when a lodge is being opened, because there's a lodge ritual, And so we're wondering, okay, did some of the brothers who died a long time ago decide they wanted to have a lodge meeting again? We never did find out, but that was something quite routine, that you'd hear those footsteps upstairs.
Now, these, obviously that was one that you just heard, but mm-hmm. Some of the other incidents, are these things that maybe you just happened to be in some place, or any of these things that you sought out?
Usually when I've gone looking, I haven't found anything.
Funny how that works.
There have been, as in going out to look at the rock with the Iohus, where the only thing happened that an expensive camera converted itself to ground metal.
Sure.
Visiting places that have a reputation for being haunted. There's quite a few of them in Seattle, and some of the other places I've been as well. And the ghosts have been very, very well behaved and quiet. That is to say, they haven't shown up at all. But the couple of times where I've had experiences, it's purely been a matter of just looking out the window or looking up this way at the right moment, and there's something moving across my field of vision, and there's somebody walking across this piece of forest just uphill, and they're making no noise even though they're walking through thick shrubbery.
Sure.
And things like that. So, you don't know. Very often with these things, you never know.
It's interesting because the Roger Patterson footage just turned 44, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, the story there was he went looking, and lo and behold...
Mm-hmm.
There it is,
And so,
for 44 years, people that have been trying to debunk this footage, like, he went looking for it, he's trying to find it, and there it is. But, I think part of that is because often when you go looking, you don't see anything.
Yeah. Still, the thing I'd point out is that many, many, many hundreds of people have gone looking.
Sure.
With cameras in their hands, looking for a Bigfoot. And He happened to be the one that was in the right place at the right time, and all these others were just kind of going, you know, film, nothing showing up.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you wrote about very early in the book, which is very interesting, because last week the show was centered around dreams.
Mm-hmm.
This show here, and we were talking about the night hag phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I've been with Steven Eisenstadt last mm-hmm. week, and. You know, he obviously is talking about dreams and night terrors and that sort of thing. And one thing that I thought was really interesting about your book when you wrote about it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, I have had sleep paralysis where I wake up and, like, I know I'm awake, but I can't open my eyes and I can't mm-hmm. move. And mm-hmm. it doesn't happen recently, but it's a really kind of terrifying thing. And mm-hmm. My dad had a night hag experience as well. And mm-hmm. his involved, man, there's something in the room and it got on me.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and the
so
thing,
the classic experience,
exactly, and that's what your book. When I read it, I was like, okay, hold on a second, because you know when I was talking about dreams with Steven Eisenstadt,
mm-hmm.
I just thought, okay, my dad had sleep paralysis, but then I read your book, and you made the very good point that the people that have what they believe is a true night hag experience, it's not just waking up paralyzed. You feel like somebody is in the room and they're getting on you. It's
very
different.
They're getting on you. They're pressing down on you. There is a feeling of evil. There's a people who, hardcore atheists, say that was really spooky. That did not feel like something natural. There's this sense of evil, there's this sense of danger, as though a threat of death is breathing down your neck, and really weirdly, in the run-up to the thing, in the minutes before the pressure starts on the chest, there is this sort of shuffling sound, like sliding footsteps going shh, 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 down this, you know. What on earth causes that? And it's possible, and of course, you know, debunkers being debunkers, people have come up with all of these complicated concatenations of circumstances. Well, this could have been that, and that could have been this. But the problem is all these things happening at the same time, in the same sequence, causing the same experience, and being interpreted, you know, in this same, this bizarre, archaic image of attack by a hostile spirit. You know, you're really pushing Occam's razor here. It would actually make more sense if there were actually an entity causing it. Except, of course, we can't allow ourselves to believe that anymore, can we?
That's just interesting because, I mean, you know, the people that have this experience,
mm-hmm.
They seem to all have the same experience.
They
which
all
is...
have the same experience. And it's a huge number of people. Anything up to one-third of the population has had this experience.
And you write about the Da Cho in Laos, who
mm-hmm.
they have, I guess, this, well, you can tell the story, the belief that they have, and,
mm-hmm.
and because of this belief, there was a period where people mm-hmm. died.
The Hmong, back in traditional Hmong society, they had the idea that, you know, they had their protective ancestral spirits, and they would make offerings to the spirits, and the spirits would protect them from a variety of noxious beings, who are called Da, and there are various Da, and Da Cho is the one that comes and sits on you in the middle of the night and crushes you and steals your breath, and you die. The description has more detail than that, and it's very much an old hag kind of description. After the Hmong fled to the United States after the end of the Vietnam War, they ended up getting a huge rate of this old hag experience that, you know, a higher rate than any other population in the world, as far as anyone's heard. And it was killing them. There were a lot of people, a lot of Hmong people, who were dying as a result of this. And that lasted until such, you know, because they came over here, they were resettled, typically in urban apartments. There was no way they could offer, you know, make their offerings to their ancestral spirits and this kind of stuff. That continued until such time as a lot of them moved out to farms, because that's how they made their living back in Southeast Asia, and a lot of them are farming now, again, and were able to pick up the pieces of their traditional religion, and the rate of death from Da Cho seems to have dropped quite sharply since then. And of course, again, the skeptics have all kinds of explanations for what kind of complex concatenation of circumstances might possibly have caused that. But the Hmong are simply saying, look, you know, we were unprotected for a while, and this thing, which we know about, our ancestors have known about it for a very long time, this thing was doing what it usually does when we don't have protection against it.
I'm always interested in things that that are very strange that everyone experiences the same way. Like, you know, the night hag is an example. And
it's an absolute classic, yeah.
Yeah, and for example, I mean, a lot of people have a dream of falling. But most people don't dream that every night. And not everybody in the world, when they sleep, has that dream. And some people have never had that dream. So, you know, it's a dream. But I've mentioned this many times on this show. My my wife in college, they went to Peru. And her class met with a shaman and had ayahuasca. And she talked about these things that she had seen. And it was just amazing because you read books from people who have taken ayahuasca, and they all see the same thing. There's there is a headless man, there is a lizard, there are a snake or something, and it's like, okay, why does everyone see the same thing? That's the part that just is like, okay, hold on. Now we're dealing with something
that's
strange.
That's where we're in very interesting territory.
Yes.
It's like the single most common kind of ghost experience, which is the one where somebody appears to you at the moment that they're dying. You know, so a close family member or a close friend either appears or there's, or like you hear their voice or something like that, a crisis apparition. And it's extremely common. It's far and away the most common variety of ghost. My dad actually had that happen to him. And now he was about as materialist as they come. You know, he did not believe in a life after death. He did not believe in anything of that kind. But there he was sitting in his home, up in his study, I think it was. And he hears his mother, my grandmother's voice, calling up the stairs, calling him by the childhood name that he always used, that she always used for him. And he got up because she was 300 miles away in a nursing home in Portland. And so he got up and went to the head of the stairs. Of course, there was no one down there. And but he'd heard it very, very clearly. And he stopped and went, well, I don't know what it is. Turned around, just started walking back, and the phone rings, and it's the people from the nursing home telling him that she's just died. I had a very, very panicky phone call about 2 minutes later because I had to talk him down. You know, because all of a sudden, his basic assumptions about the nature of reality were turned on their head. And the thing is, one of the things that I like telling people when they go through that experience is, look, it's not just you. This happened. This has happened to many, many people. It doesn't mean you're crazy. It's a normal human phenomenon that our culture, for whatever reason, has decided to pretend doesn't exist.
It is interesting in the Dacho story. I mean, this was one specific group of people that had one specific belief. But some of these things, especially the near death type of deals, you know, these happen to people that it does not matter their religion, their race, where they live. That's odd.
Yeah, well, this is, in any other context, we'd look at that and say, okay, there must be some kind of objective reality going on here. Because, I mean, all we mean when we say objective reality is that it's something that a lot of people experience. I personally have never seen an armadillo, okay? But I believe that the armadillos exist. I'm not an armadillo skeptic, because I know a lot of people have seen armadillos.
Sure.
Okay, and in fact, I know that if under the right circumstances I were to go looking for an armadillo, it's quite possible I'd see one. So that same logic, though, which would seem very sensible when applied to something like ghosts or near-death experiences or ayahuasca visions or what have you, we pretend that that doesn't work when you apply it to that, when you apply that same logic to those things, because, you know, well, they can't exist, therefore they don't exist.
We were talking about John Keel earlier and the Mothman prophecies.
Oh, yeah.
And the Mothman is obviously an all-time classic in this particular field. And what are your thoughts on that that whole strange, I don't even know how long it was, late 67, I believe.
67, I think it was. Yeah. It was about an 18-month period. Where that one corner of West Virginia was just full up with really weird things happening.
Now, go ahead.
Just stuff tumbling over each other and then finishing up with a disaster, the collapse of a bridge. Many people died, and then it ended.
Now, it's interesting because when you have a flap, a lot of things happening in one place at one time, you know, obviously, I would think that no matter what, there's going to be some degree of mass hysteria.
Of course.
There's going to be some degree of people saying, oh, my God, I, you know, they really did see a sandhill crane. And they're like, oh, my God, I saw Mothman. But what's interesting about Mothman is if you have a flap And there's a certain degree of or let's just say that you want to believe it's all mass hysteria. There's nothing mm-hmm. happening. And you have this flap, and all of a sudden, the bridge collapses. I mean, mm-hmm. to me, this would be like, okay, now the mass hysteria is going to go to a new level. You know, mm-hmm. this bridge collapsed, for crying out loud.
And in fact, it went away.
It disappeared.
When the bridge collapsed.
Very yeah. strange.
Very strange. And you get this kind of thing all the time. I have spoken to so many people who had premonitions of 9/11. Most of them didn't realize that's what it was. I mean, one person that I know, for example, had these horrible dreams where she kept on hearing this sound, this just undescribable sound of metal tearing and you know, crashing and things like that. And it kept on repeating over and over again. And that continued until shortly after 9/11, when she happened to hear a recording of one of the towers collapsing and turned as white as a sheet and said, "That's what I've been hearing all this time."
Hmm.
And you know, I was on a radio interview the other day, and the person who was interviewing me, this thing came up, and she said that yeah, she'd had these visions of the towers collapsing up to a couple of years before they actually went down.
Hmm.
So you know. This is one of those things when people have this experience and then, okay, what do you, you know, yes, it happened.
The Mothman flap mm-hmm. ended with the bridge, mm-hmm. but occasionally something would be seen again.
Oh, yeah.
And what would you say is the last report that you have heard of something happening out there?
I haven't really kept track of stuff at Point Pleasant, but I mean they get the usual assortment. I think the usual assortment of normal paranormal stuff, if you will.
Sure.
As the last real batch of stuff, you know, the last flurry of activity was in the early 70s, I think it was, as that end of the UFO phenomenon, where you had the bright lights moving up high in the sky, that was winding down in the early 70s. And so I think because that was something they saw there fairly often. People would go out on the hills and watch these things, you know, dancing around in the upper atmosphere. So that's... I you'd have to talk to somebody who'd been out there and talked to the locals and you know, was paying attention to the paranormal side of things to have any kind of idea what was that, what if anything was actually going on there.
John Keel wrote a lot about flap areas, and in your opinion, what is the deal with flap areas? Things seem to happen and they stop happening. Is it what is going on here?
We have absolutely no idea. And you know, it really is that simple. We don't know what causes things to pick up and fade off. What causes certain places to be windows, as they're sometimes called, and other places that have all the same characteristics, but you rarely even hear about a ghost there. We don't know, and that's one of the most fascinating things about it. That this whole process that seems to bring these anomalous phenomena into human consciousness and then send them fading away again. Nobody knows what it amounts to, what causes it, what makes it come, what makes it go, you know?
We have a question here from a listener. Actually, mm-hmm. first, let me ask one follow-up question for that, since we
sure.
mentioned Mothman. You have a chapter on chimeras, and Mothman is in there, and the Jersey Devil.
And
which
the Jersey
is,
Devil, yes.
Yes, another flap sort of deal, although this flap keeps returning to the Pine
yeah.
Barrens.
I don't think that the Devil has never done anything quite as spectacular as it did in, what was it, 1907, where it was all over the place for a while, and people
yeah.
were running from pillar to post, you know, the Jersey Devil here, Jersey Devil there. But no, the Devil still pops up now and again.
So in that chapter, I mean, you wrote about Mothman and Jersey Devil and the Chupacabra as well.
The Chupacabra, yeah.
Which, I guess the question is, when putting these chapters together, how did you decide where something fit? Because the Chupacabra from reports almost just seems like some sort of animal that has not yet been discovered. Whereas,
well, except for the fact that it appears and disappears out of thin air and occasionally spins through all the colors of the rainbow.
Well, there is that.
There is that, you know.
Sure.
I'm going to say, you show me, you know, this is way past merely like a chameleon shifting colors here. You know, that's to some extent, you basically have to go, I think I'm going to put it in this chapter.
Yeah.
Because the world of monsters does not submit itself to nice, neat, easy divisions and definitions. We simply don't know enough about why people experience these strange things to be able to say, okay, this is this and that is that. We can put scientific names on them, and, you know, this is the chupacabra, chupacabra mexicanensis stuffed and mounted in the Museum of Natural History. We're nowhere near that yet.
Do you know, on the topic of the Jersey Devil, do you know in the original Jersey Devil legend, the Mrs. Leeds and her 13 children, do you know when that first, what was the genesis of that legend? I mean, was this after 1907 where this thing had just been running wild? And
no,
so
it was well before then.
Well before then?
It was, I believe the legend dates from around the time of the Revolutionary War.
It's interesting. And then,
the devil had been a known phenomenon in all through the 19th century.
Sure.
And so it was simply that for some reason in 1907, he decided to go see a little more of the world and was, bouncing around in suburban Philadelphia and places like that.
Now, tell everybody, I'm sure most people have heard of the Jersey Devil, but when you think of a creature like Bigfoot, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's a giant, hairy, man-like creature.
And then there's the devil, which has
very different.
Big bat-like wings, and is more or less shaped like a scrawny kangaroo, except it has hooves, and a head kind of like a horse. And people are just stumbling all over themselves trying to find a description for this thing, because it was precisely like nothing on Earth that anyone had previously seen. But yeah, it had two legs and then two wings, no arms, stood upright, again, vaguely like a kangaroo, had a tail, head kind of like a horse, eyes occasionally described as glowing, would take off with heavy flapping wings, and, one very scary phenomenon.
Now,
there's some excellent books on the subject, and I'd certainly encourage those who live in and around Jersey to go look them up.
When the 1907 flap occurred, and I would presume at that point people knew what the thing allegedly looked like, with the horse's head and the wings and everything like that. I mean, is that largely what people saw in 1907, or did they just see a bunch of weird things and maybe a few people saw, or did everybody see a horse-headed?
It was like everybody on a tram car looking out the window as this thing rose up from near the tracks and went flapping past them, and most of the people on the tram car went into hysterics, or a dinner club suddenly looking out the back window and seeing that something is looking in. It was seen by hundreds of people. It's really one of the most baffling experiences of its kind, because so many people saw it.
Saw such a strange thing.
Saw such this bizarre creature.
Not like a light in the sky or a hairy man.
Yeah, no. A scrawny kangaroo with a horse's head and bat wings.
Yeah.
And hooves.
Let's and hooves, yes. Hooves. I don't think it's in your book, but have you ever done any investigation on Spring-Heeled Jack?
I didn't put Spring-Heeled Jack in there simply because, is he a monster? Is he what? He's certainly a bizarre phenomenon, and what is or was he? We have no idea. I haven't really looked into him because he's, I don't have a lot of access to Great Britain.
Yeah.
And that's where he was active. So
I always thought that one was fascinating because there was this guy, and he had springs on his feet.
And could do these phenomenal jumps. But, yeah.
And he had this thing on his chest that, sprayed stuff into people's eyes. And if I recall correctly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong because I don't remember the specifics, but I believe, wasn't something like in the 40s there was, a Spring-Heeled Jack wave in the U.S.?
Oh, you're thinking of the Mattoon Gasser.
Okay.
Yeah, the Mattoon Gasser. That was Mattoon. I think it was Mattoon, Illinois. I may be wrong. One of the Midwestern states, certainly.
Mad Gasser.
Medium-sized town. And this figure with a hood over his head who would just show up and spray something in people's faces and they'd pass out.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what was behind it, if anything.
It's craziness. Let me ask this one question here before we start wrapping it up. This is from a listener. He says, one of the most frequent things I see on cryptozoology-related forums are people claiming they're some kind of a shapeshifter or a werewolf.
Oh, man.
He says, how does someone researching claims like this you, for example, how do you go about deciding what am I going to investigate and what is perhaps too preposterous?
Well, to start with, when somebody starts claiming, especially you know when teenagers start claiming some exotic identity that's very fashionable in current popular horror fiction, that's not something that makes me want to run out and investigate them.
Sure.
Yes, I know there's a lot of people out there now who are convinced that they are kind of they are wolves or they're one kind of animal or another. You know, a few hundred years ago in the Native American culture, they say, okay, you have a wolf totem. Nowadays, everyone has their head full of you know, werewolf fiction, and so I must be a werewolf. Well, you know, if somebody is actually a werewolf, I want to see them take on wolf form.
Sure.
Like, right here in front of me, you know, here's, I'll set out a bowl of puppy chow. There are, I mean, maybe some of them are, for all I know. But what I've seen in that direction is primarily a matter of a lot of people who have, who are dealing with the admittedly rather depressing prospect of being an adolescent in modern American society by running headlong into Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
So what I typically do, if I want to decide what to investigate, first of all, I want something with a history behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see some, you know, if it's whether it's a ghost or whether it's a monster like the Jersey Devil or something. I want to see something that's been around. I want to see something where it's a paper trail, where there are records, where there are witnesses, maybe. And so that, you know, so it's not just one person coming up with an exalted identity to deal with, again, the very depressing prospect of being an American teenager. Certainly when I was a teenager, it sucked. And so... but beyond that, it's very much a matter of, what catches my fancy. You know, nobody can investigate everything.
Sure.
So you choose the things that are particularly interesting to you.
Now, before we go, for those that have really enjoyed this show, and I literally could talk to you for years on end, I think. It's Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings, Monsters. It's up on Amazon right now. There's a link on the front page at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You don't just write about monsters. You've got a very large bibliography here.
I think 26 books in print at this point.
26 books. And
I write for a living. You know, it happens.
That's right. UFO, Phenomenon, Fact, Fantasy, and Disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
The Druid Magic Handbook, Natural Magic. I know you work with an organic gardener, you are. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tell everybody a little bit about some of your other interests and some of your, I guess really, what is your favorite subject? And is there a particular book that you just think, man, if I had to give my kids one book that I wrote, this is it.
Well, my favorite subject is always whatever I'm researching at the moment.
Sure.
You know, I have a very omnivorous kind of literary imagination. But if really the book that I would encourage to readers alongside Monsters, which is a very entertaining book, is my latest one out, which is called Apocalypse Not, and has the subtitle, Everything You Know About 2012 Nostradamus and the Rapture is Wrong. And that's recently out from Viva Editions. You can also get it at Amazon or any other, or your local full-service bookstore will happily order it for you if they don't already have it. And it's basically a discussion of the last 3,000 years of end times that weren't.
Which brings us to last week.
Yeah, the Rapture of the Week Club.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, so the guy is a glutton for punishment is all I can say. people have been predicting that for how long now? And, you know, that's fine. Given that the Rapture itself was invented by an Irish clergyman in what was it, the 1860s, out of whole cloth. It's not in Scripture.
Sure.
It's just... there are many other things to concern yourself about than the threat that you might suddenly be beamed aboard the USS Enterprise by Saint Scotty or something.
Mm-hmm. Apocalypse not. Yes. Very, presuming the fact that it came out when it did, the world's not ending next year.
The world's not ending next year. The Mayan prophecy of 2012, there is no Mayan prophecy in 2012. It was invented out of whole cloth by Terence McKenna and Jose Arguelles, two popular figures in the 60s and 70s, sort of pop spirituality scene.
And this book available as well on Amazon and the Kindle, and it will be on my Kindle within moments. So hopefully sometime soon, maybe we can do another show and talk about Apocalypse Now.
I would be absolutely delighted. People have described it as a very entertaining book, and I certainly try to make it that way. Watching people make fools of themselves on a mass scale is always, I mean, it's the reason we like watching, you know, America's Worst Home Videos and things like that.
Sure.
This is kind of that sort of, that sort of experience on the grand scale.
Now, websites. Let's get some websites and anything else you'd like to plug out there as well.
Okay, websites. I would say my blog, which is on a range of subjects, is http://thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. And that's weekly. And other than that, if you go to www.redroom.com and click through to authors, there really isn't a faster way to do it. You'll find my Red Room page, and that has access to most of my books. And, yeah, I think those are probably the two best websites.
You can head up there as well to Wikipedia if you head up to...
You can always check Wikipedia.
Yep. Yeah. All of the links are up there on Wikipedia, in fact, and the bibliography as well. And again, as we noted, the book we talked about today was Monsters, an Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings. It's been reissued after a decade of success. It's available on the Kindle as well. So, of course, if you have an iPad, iPhone, pretty much, if you have a computer, if you're listening to this, you can get this book, guaranteed. And Amazon.com as well for Apocalypse Not. Everything you know about 2012, Nostradamus, and the Rapture is wrong. Both of these books are available, and it's full bibliography as well. And Mr. Greer, I want to thank you very much for doing the show today. I really enjoyed it. And
thank you. I've had a good time.
Yes, back on again to talk about the apocalypse that is not to be.
I would love to be on.
Awesome. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate it. AfterDarkRadioShow.com is a place to go, so check it out. We'll talk to you again next week.